Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. You've touched on a little bit some of the issues that come up, and we certainly can't hit on all of them. What are some of the other things you see regularly that now our attorneys are clued in, and what do we need to look for? What do we need to ask about?
Yeah. And some of the materials that Lambda Legal has worked on with CWLA and a number of other organizations, we've kind of captured like some of the challenges that LGBTQ youth face into a few categories. One is isolation. So we've touched on that a little bit, Matt. The object isn't to do like the Harry Potter sorting hat so we know how everybody identifies, but what we do know is that the isolation of keeping inside and not being able to talk about who you are and what you need actually fuels depression, you know, all these other bad public health outcomes. So the goal of having an affirming system so young people can be out when they're ready to be out is good for their well-being, which is, of course, one of our core objectives. So that's one piece. Victimization is another one. Emotional harm, psychological harm, physical harm in placement settings. Another one is we want you to go to counseling, but you have to take a bus here and there to get to this appointment. So if you are, say, a trans girl of color, right, what is that bus trip like for you? Are you literally risking your life every time we're asking you to get on public transportation? So that's another one. A lack of family-centered services. So are we basically just writing off your family of origin if they've been rejecting to you versus providing targeted services to promote acceptance? So maybe even if you can't go home, maybe you don't have a toxic relationship with your parents, which we know impacts well-being seriously and permanency, of course, down the road. So a lack of competent providers. So we are sending you to Dr. So-and-so for a psychological evaluation. Has Dr. So-and-so ever worked with LGBT people before or is competent in that? Because we know how much those evaluations drive case planning, services, all those other things, right? So those are kind of our main issues. I think the other one is just what we call differential treatment. So are you experiencing rules in care differently? So that comes up, for example, in, say, a group home. So obviously group homes have to have policies around making sure kids are safe and there's not inappropriate contact going on. But if you're a gay young man placed in a same-sex setting, asking you not to have absolutely normal teenage feelings around crushes and relationships and dating in that setting is obviously very different if you're a heterosexual young man placed in this setting. So, you know, is holding hands something that is going to get you discharged in that setting when that rule doesn't even apply to a heterosexual kid in the situation because it doesn't come up, right? So just kind of navigating those waters. So those are kind of the larger buckets that we use. And I think they can also be a guide for attorneys asking questions like around the experiences of their clients in those different areas and making sure, you know, just on the service provider example, like just knowing that that can be something that can go south for an LGBTQ youth can prompt you to say, what do you know about this provider that this young person's being referred to? What are their policies? Do they have experience working with these populations? Have you seen any evaluations? You know, are they qualified? If they're not, and they're the only option in town, are they actually willing to consult with someone who is an expert in this area so they can gain some knowledge if they're, as we far too often see, there's one opening, there's one slot, there's one appointment, there's one person.
Yes, I mean.
I know this is reality, but we still have to ask the question because, you know, if we're then expecting somebody who doesn't have any experience and is not affirming and expecting our client to share all this information that's relevant and get something that is meaningful and going to be helpful for this young person and for the case going forward, we wouldn't send somebody who was having some particular medical issue to just some doctor that had no qualifications or experience.
But we do all the time. And because we don't think about it, I guess. Right? And
I think we do obviously use a lot of folks that otherwise we wouldn't send kids to because that Medicaid pays for it, or you name your thing. So sure. But we, I mean, there aren't perfect parallels, but I mean, we wouldn't send somebody who we think may have diabetes to a doctor that has not, has no experience whatsoever in treating diabetes. I mean, we don't necessarily treat things parallel.
Right.
As we should.
If we're trying to get kids home as quickly as possible, and yet we have a child now who's overrepresented in the system, and we have all these other issues to work with, how do we focus? Should we focus on their emotional stability in terms of dealing with all the pushback, I guess, they're getting in society? Or do we force a resolution of the placement as quickly as possible? Do we get them out of the system and into a placement, and then work with the placement somehow to get them stable, get the child stable?
Well, I'll say that at the moment, I think with the way a lot of systems function, we have some really difficult situations, choices to make, because we know there aren't enough services for parents to move to a place of acceptance. Some places don't have a go-to person. They're not focused on that. We know that there are a lack of affirming foster home placement. So LGBTQ end up in congregate care at higher rates that have nothing to do with their needs and everything to do with lack of homes that will take them. So, you know, at the moment we're in a tough place, but I like to think about what I think is a all youth in foster care kind of homelessness pipeline, you know, as you go down from reunification as your number one permanent plan down the chain to getting into the shelter cycle, flowing out of care and not having someone who's your person who's non-system involved. There's an LGBTQ version that at every stage along that path, you know, if we aren't targeting services to parents, if we aren't really doing some serious family finding and working with relatives who may not be at a place of support the moment we encounter them, but could get there, if we're not making those efforts at every stage, you know, looking at fictive kin, looking at other places, doing some specific recruitment in the community. So not just saying, we don't have that. And I'll give you a concrete example about that after this. But like at every stage, as we go down the line, we have to be pushing back against the crappiness of the system in general.
Yeah.
And the I'm getting really technical here. The specific crappiness has to do with LGBTQ kids here. But it's like, you know, talking to our clients and really like we are the person who can help flag for the system about potential placements. And sometimes that may be, well, do you think that uncle that you're not really sure about, is there some room there? Like, do you think we could work with them? It may be us pushing as counselors too. So the example I was going to share is a case that we were involved in Louisiana, a trans girl who had been in the system for a long time, just an enormous amount of trauma, had ended up in detention through a whole complicated series of events. And the child welfare system was basically saying, even though the judge gave them discretion to release if they had a placement, they were, we don't have any. We've exhausted all our resources. She's too difficult. They weren't even trying. And the guardian ad litem for the young person had actually reached out at her church to explain the situation. And a gay couple stepped up. We were involved at this point. They found out about her on a Sunday at church. On Monday night, they were meeting with me to hear more about her. On Tuesday, they were meeting with her in detention. And on Wednesday, they were at a contested disposition hearing testifying that they were willing to take her to their home.
Wow, yeah.
So I think it's a good, you know, it's what we should always be there as attorneys for children, of like never taking no for an answer kind of approach, but with a specific twist here. You know, well, call in the recruitment person as a witness at the permanency hearing. Who have you talked to? What have you done? Have you just gone to your same usual suspects for placement?
Yeah.
Well, shocker. You haven't turned up anything new or different.
Right.
So I think there's lots of specific techniques that we can use to push against what is in general not a great model.
Right.
when it sounds, you know, it's interesting because we do podcasts on a lot of different topics and things like keeping siblings together. It's the exact same discussion in that, yeah, it can be a challenge if you have three or four, but what you're describing is exactly the kinds of things that you would be doing in that instance. It's a barrier, but it doesn't mean we just accept what's there.
Right. It doesn't mean you accept what the agency is saying. And I think the other piece is that I think it's good for attorneys to know that there is a lot of movement. Like, people who do family acceptance work see a tremendous amount of movement in families to a better place. I think, and I included myself in this until I started working at Lambda and was just more aware of what was going on out there, that if you were rejecting, then you were just, we're moving you over here to the dustbin. You know, oh, that's not possible, right? But people who do family acceptance targeted work are not focusing on demonizing parents because of their beliefs or trying to get them to change their beliefs necessarily, but are focused on their behaviors and trying to find that common ground that you may not want your child to be LGBTQ because what you hear about LGBTQ people from the world is all negative. So why would you want that for your kid? But you're actually, like, your behaviors are causing those outcomes. So sort of working with parents on those behaviors, like the program in Las Vegas, Pivot, that's run out of the LGBT Center in Las Vegas, they have had a 99% success rate with parents.
Wow.
With their family acceptance.
Meaning, when you say success, meaning they turn around and welcome their children.
Now, that may not necessarily mean, like, you get to be back at home for all of them at that particular moment. But it does mean moving from, like, a toxic, negative relationship to a better place of acceptance and understanding.
Wow.
And the research from the Family Acceptance Project says if you move parents from a highly rejecting place to a moderately rejecting place, which is kind of a weird concept, but, you know, saying, like, I mean, we hear parents say things like, you're dead to me. I wish you were never born. Mm-hmm. I never want to see you again. I mean, that's the level of rejection some youth face. And if you move parents from that to, I still love you, I need a minute, I don't understand this, but I'm still here, that drops a lot of these negative outcomes. And I think what I've moved to, too, I think in talking with children's lawyers about talking to the court about this and the agency as well, is moving a little bit from a rights, a civil rights framework, which I'm loath to do, given that I work at an LGBT civil rights organization,
yeah,
but
yeah.
And moving to a well-being and safety framework, and of course permanency, but I think well-being in particular, I mean, all of the research, all of the professional standards around how kids are to be treated are really clear about what we should be doing for kids and about the totally tangible difference one affirming person makes, or using the name of a trans youth uses in one context of their life improves outcome. You know, moving parents to just a slightly better place improves outcomes. And I think that kind of moves people in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's encouraging because I think, you know, as I look at all the things that are impacted for the child, it can feel overwhelming, which is true in a lot of different child welfare cases. But hearing that these simple changes can help increases the likelihood of permanency because, you know, if the child is doing better and even if they don't go to live with their parents, if that's no longer toxic, I mean, that's a quantifiable, and, you know, you're improving their odds of being in a stable placement and their well-being. And so I think that's very encouraging. So I think it's been really helpful to talk about the things that we can do in individual cases. But, you know, part of improving permanency and outcomes is that we need the system to change. And so we'd love to hear a little bit from you on, you know, what types of changes we need to be advocating for at a higher level.
Sure. I think one of the things that I've really been focusing on in the last few years, you mentioned the Safe Havens report that we wrote with Children's Rights and the Center for the Study of Social Policy. And in that, we did an analysis of what states have explicit protection against discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, in either state statute, regulation, or policy. And surprisingly to us, 29 states have sexual orientation and gender identity somewhere somehow in one of those three areas. So that's actually really encouraging, which means that as an advocate, you've got that tool, which, I mean, we know having that written down on a piece of paper doesn't translate into a better lived experience all the time. But it's a tool for right. you to use as an advocate. And so, you know, I think the first step is for attorneys is knowing actually like what the law says in their law and policy says. And so if you don't have those protections, then that's a really great first step. And what we have seen in several jurisdictions I've been working in is actually just calling the question, like, hey, judge, hey, agency director, can we get together with some of the systemic players and just have a brown bag, have a conversation about LGBTQ in our county, our state, our city? What are people seeing? What do we need to do? What can we do? What do we have the capacity to do? Literally anything helps.
Right.
Because what we found, I mean, just as an example, we are working with folks in Idaho in the child welfare system. And we reached out with Children's Rights and the local LGBT center and a gay young man who's an alum of foster care and living in Boise, and asked them to just do an LGBTQ policy. And they said, well, hey, our foster youth advisory board actually brought this up to us, so we're working on it, but we would love some input and consulting. And on the call, the state person, that the LGBT center person, was talking about the clients in child welfare that were coming into the center. And the state person said, well, have you ever had a conversation with the state office about like services and how to work together? No, he hadn't, right? And this was us like coming in, like just getting together the meeting mm-hmm. and seeing people who were about eight blocks from one another who'd never had a conversation about this population. And we have just seen in different ways and different shapes, you know, that result in changes in statute, changes in policy, changes in practice, and analysis of the providers in the system. Because in some places, they've never even thought to ask, what are the experiences of our LGBTQ youth when they go out to these providers that we have for them? So my advice is just ask the questions, bring people together, you know, it can't hurt,
right.
And you may actually, you know, or the other thing, we know there are tons of like task forces and work groups and like all of these things going on, right?
Always.
But some of those haven't thought about LGBTQ youth and their particular experiences within that. And so even that can be, well, hey, we've been working on all of this, but let's think just very explicitly for a minute about how LGBTQ youth fit into what we're doing, and particularly LGBTQ youth of color, like what's going on with them, right? And then that can lead to having a different approach.
So if somebody hears this and they're like, well, of course, that's a great idea. You know, I'm regularly convening with people. Are there places to find like a great policy, or is there a state you'd look to for the ideal statute? I mean, are there some specific resources like that we could point people to?
Sure. So in the Safe Havens report, mm-hmm. We have a lot of examples of good policy, examples of good regs. For example, in a lot of places, you hear that trans girls can't be placed in a girls' group home because of licensing regulations, for example. So we have a whole section about that, advice for attorneys. So, and in that report and on Lambda's website, if you do Lambda Legal map child welfare, Lambda Legal map juvenile justice, you can actually pull up a map of the whole country, click on the state, and the purple states have LGBTQ specific policies. And we're in the final stretch, I hope, of actually a model LGBTQ child welfare policy that we're doing with a whole host of organizations that'll be out later this summer. The other thing that I think is helpful for attorneys in that is it was published in April 2017 and ended up being a good time because it caught all of the advances and reforms that occurred during the Obama administration at the federal level. Some of those are in the process of being repealed or pulled back, but none of them have been yet. So we also summarize at least what to date was the constitutional law, the federal case law, as it relates to this area.
Okay.
So you can almost use it as a, like plopping into a motion.
Right, wonderful. Yeah. So, that's very helpful.
Which is the other thing, I think, going back to some of the tips, I would say, you know, that's something that I would encourage lawyers to do as well, is like, you know, file a motion on this area.
Right.
Like, if your client's not being referred uniformly in court and by the agency by the name that they use, file a motion. Like, we've seen a lot of judges issue an order. Like, this child shall be referred to by this name going forward in all documents, in all hearings. Yeah, some simple things like that, right? Healthcare is another one, right, to file a motion about if your client's not getting the healthcare that they need. I mean, I think, you know, using the advocacy tools that you know work in other areas, but tweaking them for this one is a good strategy as well.
It's great.
So before we wrap up, is there anything that you'd like to share with our audience that we haven't asked you?
Well, one thing we touched upon but didn't really delve into that I think is important too is trauma and sort of the experiences of LGBTQ youth. And I think that's something that for folks who aren't a part of the LGBTQ community, we talk a lot about privilege, or I think that's a real important area to think about how your clients are navigating the world on a day-to-day basis. A young woman that I've worked with quite a bit, who's trans and biracial, I've heard people within systems to tell her, pick your battles.
Wow.
Because, you know, experiencing discrimination or harassment or misgendering on a daily basis and having had a whole history of trauma, sometimes the response is, you know, to yell or hit or, you know, these things that we know so much about, if, you know, if you have a PTSD diagnosis, like what your response is, but yet we are not really offering young people any particular tools about how to navigate an environment that is harmful and harassing and discriminatory on a daily basis. And saying pick your battles is not extraordinarily helpful.
No.
Right.
No, it's not.
You know, so I think, you know, we do need to step out of ourselves for a minute and appreciate how having a history of trauma and trying to navigate a world that is full of discrimination, how challenging that really is on a daily basis, and also how a young person's response to that can lead to incarceration, justice system involvement, placement in residential treatment facilities, like these sorts of things that then we know statistically don't go well and often lead to homelessness and, you know, this whole host of problems. So that's the other thing I think I would make sure that attorneys push back on, is I keep hearing like, well, where is this place for like the facility that's great with trans youth? I'm like, okay, let's back up. Like, why are we talking about a facility to start with?
Yeah.
Right. And we know that these facilities in general, like, are not great. And so if we're thinking about a gendered environment, like where a person who, you know, maybe clashing against people's ideas of gender norms to start with, and placing them in that environment and placing them out of state, like, it's just a laundry list of this makes no sense. So,
well, yeah. And to what you said earlier, it's we should go through the same fighting at every step down the permanency path as we would for any other kid.
Right.
And instead of going straight to assuming facility, looking for people, all of those things, right?
Right, right. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think the takeaways for that are, it's almost impossible to underestimate, the experiences of your client. I think if they're LGBTQ related to trauma, and making sure that we're thinking about that always, and also making sure that while as a general rule we know we need to avoid congregate care, I think that's particularly true for LGBTQ youth, because of the challenges that they face in most of those settings now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think kind of doubling down, like, for those clients is really important. And the final thing I'll say is that I kind of feel like the other number one thing we can do is just be fighting justice involvement and push into the justice system at every single moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of our pipelines, like, particularly for LGBT youth of color, come down hard. And, right, being involved in the justice system is just extra hard for LGBTQ youth. So, like, if you're seeing those things unfold, it's really time to just push back hard. So one thing I mentioned earlier was just about making sure that a psychologist or social worker, whomever is doing an evaluation of your client, is competent. I think that connects with our conversation about trauma as well. So some of the psychologists that I work with who have a lot of expertise in this area will see, for example, a prior evaluation that has schizoaffective disorder, this other long list of diagnoses, and from their experience of working with LGBTQ youth, they can say what's happening here is PTSD, and say if it's a trans young person, a gender dysphoria diagnosis. And like those two things explain a lot of what's happened, is happening with them, happened to them, and also really drives the whole different set of recommendations for how the system should respond to them and the services that they need, that aren't the same with a whole host of other diagnoses that are probably inaccurate. So I think, again, making sure that we are to the best of our ability in a system that isn't really known for being well tailored to the unique and specific needs of children, well, that we must push in this area to make sure that we're getting it, you know, for our LGBTQ clients.
I have to say, this has been a great interview. I mean, we've been both doing this for a very long time, and I have to admit, I felt stupid. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time and sharing with us. And I, in your speaking about it, it raised me, things came to me like, okay, we need to actually probably do a whole podcast on how you have emotion that would, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's all
yeah.
of it to address all of these issues. Mm-hmm. It's very, very awesome. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And I think the takeaway for all of us is, I wasn't doing this perfectly. You know, even as a gay person, like I'm representing clients. I mean, we all have new things we can learn, and, you know, that things are, younger generations are redefining gender, redefining sexuality in ways we haven't even thought about.
Right.
And so I think to some degree we can sort of let ourselves off the hook in a bit that like, it's impossible to catch up and be an expert on this. But I think what LGBT young people are telling us is like, talk to us about it. You know, be open about it, have a conversation with us, indicate that you're willing to learn. And number one, like that you're here for me, because they may not have anybody else who's really here for them.
Sad.
It is. It's sad, but true.
Right.
But I mean, you can be that person.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.